Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we talk about An Enemy of the People, Grace, Heresy, and lots of other Broadway news, so please stay tuned.
I'm crossing you in style someday. Old dream maker, you heartbreaker, wherever you're going, I'm going your way. Two drifters off to see the world. There's such a lot of world to see. We're after the same rainbow's end, waiting round the bend. My huckleberry friend, Moon River and me.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, October 14th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantiere. Peter writes for Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, for Critcherland on Fridays, and the MTI blog throughout the month. Good morning, Peter.
Hi.
Also with us is Michael Portantiere. Michael is a writer and a photographer. You can see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You could see his photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. Michael also writes for outlets such as the Sondheim Review. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
All righty. So the three of us, we're back together again. So we have a lot of ground to cover this morning. We're going to start off by covering a show that's been open for a few weeks. We didn't cover it yet. It's called Enemy of the People. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Well, this is a newer version of the famous Ibsen play about a guy who thinks he's doing a good thing for his town and is rather naive about it. The town has an industry that depends on water, the springs, yeah, he has found out that this water is not good and that it's going to infect people. And he truly believes that everybody is going to say, oh, thank you. Thank you so much for pointing that out. I mean, now lives will be saved. And he finds out slowly but surely that everybody, including his brother, is very much against him because, indeed, he's going to kill the industry in the town. So this has always been a play that has had a lot of resonance, but perhaps more so even today because, of course, many of us feel that we live in such a corrupt society that we're certainly the story becomes more believable than it ever has, I think, as we hear more and more things about our own politicians and people of industry. And it must have been shocking when this play first broke, because I imagine, and all I'm saying is imagine, I imagine that things didn't seem as corrupt then, or there weren't as many ways of finding out that people were corrupt then as we have now with investigative reporters and so many other people who were there to tell us what the truth is, or perhaps tell us what their version of the truth is. It's very hard to believe anything anymore. And but when this play broke, it must have been really astonishing. That said, it still packs a wall up today from the vantage point that we nod along with it, saying, yeah, that makes sense why that would happen. And so I think Boyd Gaines does a very nice job indeed in trying to be the good guy in this play and really believing it's all going to work out. That people are really going to, as time goes on, the conscience of the people will really very much support what he's doing. While Richard Thomas, as the mayor of the town, his brother, is trying to point out the realities to him and at first, you know, rather nicely, but as time goes on, rather severely. And, you know, brotherly love takes a back seat here to commerce. So this is a play that while it's an Ibsen play from way back when, it's fascinating to me how it speaks even louder today. And, you know, for those who have seen the Steve McQueen movie, and it seems odd to think that Steve McQueen would take on this part, but he was fascinated with this play too. And he did a movie version. I dare say you're better off seeing this revival on Broadway than seeing the McQueen movie, which was a noble failure. This is not a noble failure. This is still riveting. It's a cut-down production in the sense that Ibsen's play was substantially longer. This translation does omit a few things. But the point is well made. I think Boyne Gaines is very good, but I have to admit, still the finest performance I've ever seen of this play was done at Williamstown some years ago when Mandy Patinkin did it, because you can imagine the scene where finally our doctor here tries to tell the town, really, come on, I mean, this is serious now. And you can imagine Mandy Patinkin at a fever pitch. Boyd Gaines doesn't quite get to that fever pitch. He's very, very good, but I have to admit that Mandy Patinkin stays in my mind as the quintessential performer I've seen in this role. Still, a very good production and certainly worth seeing.
All right, Michael, what do you think?
Yeah, I have known this play since college or maybe even high school, but this was the first production of it I ever saw. Sorry I didn't see that Williamstown. That sounds really interesting to hear. And I thought it was very, well, I thought it was extremely powerful. That's an excellent point, Peter. I would also imagine that at the time, you know, authority was just not questioned as much, and it was assumed that there wasn't all of this hypocrisy covering up really, really dangerous things in order, you know, just for immediate gain and profit. Mm-hmm. Now we're like, oh, you know, yeah, what else is new? But it's still very powerful to see this fellow struggling, you know, against everyone, and the scene at the end at the town meeting, where he's so eloquent, and yet the town just—it's like a mob mentality, and they turn against him. It's very, very painful. I find, which I'm sure it was meant to be. I like the adaptation very much. I don't know the play that well to know exactly what was cut out, but I suspect it wasn't anything that was terribly important. I think it's the kind of play that tends to benefit from a leaner version, a swifter version. So Rebecca Lenkowitz is the woman who did the adaptation, so she deserves, I think, a great amount of credit. And the acting of Boyd Gaines and Richard Thomas as his brother and the rest of the company, I thought, was uniformly excellent. I did think there were some very strange things about it. Just one specific thing. Peter, do you know why they used this piece of very sheer fabric to sort of in the place of almost a proscenium curtain, and they would remove it at the start of each scene, but it didn't cover the whole stage. You could see through it anyway, and I couldn't understand what the point of that piece of fabric was. Did you?
No, I imagine it was just something the designer wanted, but I didn't see any symbolism attached to it at all.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was wondering.
There may be, but I can't say it occurred to me.
I do have to say I felt that it was really not very well directed by Doug Hughes, exemplified in one particular scene, the first big confrontation between the two brothers. Now, you know, when I discussed The Elixir of Love at the Met a few weeks ago, and how Bartlett Sher had made some very odd decisions in staging the comedy. And the thing is, you know, when you can argue with a director's interpretation of something, and I'm sure we all do. But then there it does seem to me that there are very basic things that you learn as an actor, as a director. And when people violate them, I always wonder, is it possible that they don't know these basic things? Do they disagree with them, or do they just, you know, do they just not pay attention? And what happened in this scene is the big scene where the brothers sit down, and what's supposed to happen is that the conversation escalates from a very nice, polite, rational conversation to a very angry, very, very pointed, intense, desperate confrontation between the two of them. But in this version, they start screaming almost from the minute they sit down. And it's quite a long, conversation between just the two of them. I would say, I don't know, maybe 10 minutes almost. And it was much less effective, even with these two excellent actors, than it would have been if a director had said, guys, you know, you have to modulate it. Obviously, you have to start somewhere and then go to somewhere else. So I do not know why, again, I don't know if it was a conscious decision or just carelessness, but I was very surprised at that. And that was also mirrored in other sections of the play where it seemed like people were yelling much more than they should have been, and it would have been more effective if they had not been yelling. So that I didn't quite get, but it is a tribute to the actors and to the play that it was extremely powerful, despite that what I would say is a pretty major flaw.
All right. So why don't we move on to the next one, which is another Broadway opening, Grace. Michael, why don't you start us off with Grace?
I liked it very much. It's so great to see a new play that that's really good. And this is at the Court, which is not known to be a house of hits. So maybe it's silly,
no, it's true. It's true.
Yeah, but for that reason, I think maybe I had lower expectations. I mean, is that silly? I don't know.
Well, you know, it's funny. William Goldman this season points out that there are good houses and bad houses, and the Long Acre is the one he uses, but he could have very well easily used the Court. But right. The thing is that I'll never forget when I first read his line, trying to rebut, saying, you know, a good show, people will see it anywhere. And Rent certainly proved that, because that was a very bad house too. The Needle End of the Billy Rose, the Trafalgar, as was called for a while. What's so interesting to me is the line that he wrote. He said, I would imagine that only about 2% of the Broadway public can tell you what theaters their favorite shows were in. Of course, that's true. And one of the reasons it makes me laugh is because usually I can't remember what theaters that I've seen my favorite shows, but or even my unfavorite shows. But it is true that the Court is one, despite the success of the Magic Show many, many moons ago, which wasn't supposed to be a hit, that the Court really is, as they say, a death house. Anyway, go on.
Well, anyway, yes. And I guess mostly it's considered to be a death house because it's east of Broadway. Mm-hmm. You know, what a silly, like, you know, it's about half a block east of Broadway. I never quite got that. But anyway, I thought it was a really wonderful play. I'm not sure that I got everything in it. But to make a long story short, Paul Rudd, in a wonderful performance, plays this fellow who wants to, he's moved from Minnesota, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with his wife, and they are Christians, or, you know, it seems, and he wants to start a chain of gospel-themed hotels or motels in Florida, and let's just say it does not go well. And their neighbor in this condominium complex is by the way, the wife is played by Kate Arrington. Her name is Sarah. Paul Rudd plays Steve, and their neighbor Sam is played by Michael Shannon, the extraordinary actor who I have not seen on stage since he did Bug downtown. I'm not sure if he's done anything on stage since that, because he then went to become a movie star and just been doing really well at that, movie and TV. But anyway, Sam, the Michael Shannon character, is this really unfortunate fellow who lost his wife or girlfriend, I can't remember now, in a horrific car accident, and his face was extremely damaged, and so he wears sort of a half mask. It's interesting. This play, in most ways, could not be more different from The Phantom of the Opera, but there is a scene that's extremely similar, where Sarah becomes very close with Sam, which is one of the which leads to tragedy eventually. But she becomes very close to him, and she wants to. She says she wants to see what he looks like under the mask, and he is, of course, very reluctant. And she, at one point, moves as if to take it off herself, just as in Phantom. But then he sort of does it, and he displays his face, which is pretty horrific looking, and excellent makeup job, by the way, for this production. This is one of those plays where it is difficult to talk too much about the plot without giving away some moments that are very, very powerful. But let me say there is a fourth character of an exterminator named Carl, played by Ed Asner, who is so fantastic on stage. So great to have him back. And just complications ensue because of Sarah becoming close to Sam and Steve becoming very jealous of that. And also, even more importantly, there is this shadow investor. I mean, shades of Rebecca. There's this fellow who has promised a tremendous amount of money to fund this chain of gospel hotels. But Steve says that he hasn't heard from him in 29 days. And somehow, you know, but he said, oh, you know, but he'll come through. The money will come through. And it doesn't, at least not during the course of what we see happen. And so he becomes more and more desperate for that reason, and everything goes really, really kind of awfully wrong. So I thought it was a wonderful play. The dialogue was very well written by Craig Wright, who really is one of our best playwrights, I have to say. I really think so. And as I say, I didn't get every single moment of it. Ed Asner, as I said, plays an exterminator. There's a subplot where Steve, played by Paul Rudd, starts itching, and he can't figure out what it is, and then it later turns out that it's has something to do with the pesticides or whatever that Ed Asner's character has been using. And I wasn't sure I imagine that must be a metaphor for something or have some reference on as to what else is happening in the play. I'm not sure I totally got that. But other than that, I thought it was very interesting. There are lots of, to me, extremely fascinating discussions of religion versus atheism, and you know what kind of tragedies would cause people to turn away from God if they were initially religious. So I thought it was extremely worthwhile, and I'm very glad it's on Broadway.
All right, Peter, what did you think?
I loved it as well. I was very impressed by the religious versus agnostic feeling about it. I'm very Craig Wright gets off easily at the beginning because what a wonderful way to get out exposition by having Paul Rudd say to Kate Arrington, "Oh, let's get down on our knees and pray. Oh Lord, we have come all this way." You know, I mean, it's you know, it's true. You know, it's a great way to get out exposition.
Yeah.
Ed Asner makes a good play a point when he comes in because he talks about that. Being an exterminator is not anybody's dream job. He did it after retiring because, as he says, daytime TV, give me a break. Yes, there's a lot to be said for that. You know, any job is better than staying home watching daytime TV. So I think that was really a nice little point. Now, they're not just Christians; they're born again Christians,
yes.
And that's a very different thing, you know. And Paul Rudd is very good at expressing that happy-go-lucky, goofy naivete that those who have that extra dose of recent faith have. And you really get the impression that this is just the next stop on his life list. I mean, what I mean is, you know how in Pippin, Pippin is looking to find himself, and he finds war, he finds sex.
Right.
Well, this is just one of the things that you get that impression that there are some people for which this becomes a phase. And for a while, it does seem like he's the real thing because he's looking for money. After all, because this guy has not come through, that money was supposed to come in one day. And as Michael points out, 29 days have now passed. So he's desperate for money, and he tries to get some money from the man who's been seriously injured. And wow, you know, I mean, the guy even does give him the money. And yet we do see that in Paul Rudd's mind that indeed this is not the be-all and end-all for him, because eventually he gives back that money because he feels that the guy doesn't have enough faith. He harangues him. That's a very he always says to people casually, as he does to Asden first, I'm just curious about your beliefs. Can we just talk about your beliefs? I mean, that fascinates me in people. You know, that type of thing. Like, it's just going to be this arbitrary discussion. Like, do you like your meat well done? Do you like it rare? Do you like it medium? You know, it's going to be this discussion with no ramifications whatsoever. But boy, you know, if you don't agree with him, hook, line, and sinker, he's going to tell you off about what's wrong with you and your life. You know, and you know, it's very hard for this gentleman who has half his face scraped off, who has lost his—I believe it's a fiancée, Michael, but I think that's what it was. But
yeah.
Anyway, the love of his life, let's say that, and to think that God's this great thing, you know, who loves us and takes care of us, and you know, is a good and loving shepherd. And all that. It's very hard when you've had something like this happen to you to say, "Gee, God's neat," you know? I mean, so, but anyway, Paul Rudd goes off on this tear, you know, oh, you're mad at God, you know? I mean, and really, you know, it's and I've been in discussions like that with people, so I know that really struck me as being very real. And yet, he does seem to be the real thing when he gives back that check, so I think that was good. But the point is, these religious people who are super religious, at the end of the play, he can't believe that his wife is involved with this guy. You're in love with this guy? With this face? You know, well, some religious guy. I mean, you know, he's really quite a person, you know. I mean, when the chips are really down, you know, I brought my wife down here. I brought my life down here, he says, you know, because he's amazed. It's gone. By the way, when they do the musical version, there's that lyric right in place. I brought my wife down here. I brought my life down here. You know, there it is. Yeah. Do you know that I once did a study that I started with Oklahoma. There has never been a moment on Broadway where there hasn't been one musical where wife and life has not been rhymed. I guarantee you, dating back to at least 1943 and probably before. So anyway, that's in place there. But a nice discussion of religion, no question. And bring up the point that a lot of people, you know, have this knee-jerk reaction with religion, that they just believe everything, and it's the easiest way to establish that you're a good person. That's what's interesting. You know, I believe in God. I love God. You know, I'm a God fearing person. All those things. You know, people automatically react and say, "Oh, then he's a good person." And Craig Wright points out there's a lot more to it than that. That you don't just become good just by buying into a religion and or even following a lot of its precepts. It's much more complicated than that. And that's what makes Grace a pretty fascinating evening in the theater.
So do we see this as being any staying power here? It seems to be the promotion for it's all centered around Paul Rudd.
I'm not sure if it's I imagine it's a limited engagement. Yeah,
well, you know, they always start as limited engagements.
Yes.
Right, but in this case, isn't I'm going to show my TV ignorance. Isn't Michael Shannon on? Isn't he on?
Yeah,
yeah.
But I'm wondering if they would recast it and move it to a Broadway theater that might be empty or something like that.
Well, the thing is, of course, that Ben Brantley liked Michael Shannon quite a bit. Most of his review centered on that.
That's true.
And you know, there is a history with Heather Headley and Kristen Chenoweth. When Brantley raves, the Tony is not far behind. And the thing is that because that was the power of Brantley's review, and it was. I mean, he liked Michael Shannon more apparently than the play, because he certainly spent more time talking about Michael Shannon, who's very good. And you know what else he is? I think, I don't know, he reminded me very much of Marlon Brando. It was a very Brando-esque performance, and isn't it interesting that that is an adjective that's still used? I'm not the only one who uses that, Brando-esque. So, under those circumstances, I think they'd lose a lot of steam if they recast it. I don't know. It again, this is a heady play, and we are living in an era where heady plays aren't welcome for very long. So,
is a heady play, but there also is a lot that happens in it that's very visceral. And so I don't think that would necessarily be a problem in itself. And Michael Shannon, it's Boardwalk Empire, by the way, that he's on. I just confirmed that by looking at the bio. Who would think to do that? I think he already has been getting a lot of attention and buzz over the past few years. So with Brantley's rave on top of that, yeah, Peter's point is very well taken. I think that as long as he stays in it, and then plus the fact that Paul Rudd is really, you know, has been in some of the most popular movies of recent times, and Ed Asner, you know, a beloved figure from television himself, and Kate Arrington, I'm looking here, I guess her only previous Broadway credit was The American Plan, but she's from Steppenwolf, and she's done quite a bit of off-Broadway and a lot of work out in Chicago, obviously. She was wonderful also.
Absolutely.
You know, she has a scene with Michael Shannon where it becomes, we learn that Sarah is not as 100% dyed-in-the-wool, born-again Christian as she might at first seem to be. Mm-hmm. And that was very well, very, very well written and acted. I really love the play, too.
I did, too. You know, this is a play that didn't have good word of mouth before it opened.
I guess not, did it? Yeah.
I didn't expect all that much from the reviews, because there were a lot of people who truly hated it. And I have to say, though, that two people I know who saw it before I did, who didn't like it at all, are extraordinarily religious people. And as a result, it may be that they were terribly threatened by it. So that's a possibility as well. So it may be better for those have questions about faith going into it, rather than people who, it might be just be too threatening for those who believe that every word of the Bible, is exactly accurate. And there are no mistakes in it whatsoever, even though it was a book that was printed so long ago and under difficult circumstances in terms of publishing and all that. I mean, there is that famous thing about in Henry the Fourth, Part Two, I think it is, when Mistress Quickly, it's Henry V, when Falstaff dies. And for years, there was consternation because nobody could understand the line the Mistress Quickly says about he tabled of green pastures. And what does that mean? You know, and finally somebody found it was a different copy, that said he babbled of green pastures. And what that mean? And then people said, oh, you mean when he was dying, he said the 23rd Psalm, the Lord is my shepherd, so they figured out. So that was in the 1600s. That was, taken down, you know.
So that was 1600
years before the Bible, you know. So to think that, you know, there's never been a mistake made in the Bible is something. Even a few years ago, Ruth Westheimer had a book come out that where there was a mistake. A knot was put in or a knot wasn't put in, but it changed the whole meaning of the sentence. It has something to do with birth control, I think. Anyway, so that was in our times, you know, and mistakes get made. But there are people who believe that every word in the Bible is exactly accurate, and it could very well be differently. So as a result, if that strikes a chord with you with what I've just said, fine, you may enjoy grace, but if not, you may not.
Right.
I was looking here at Kate Arrington's bio, and she was in Iceman Cometh at Goodman with Nathan Lane and Brian Dennehy.
Right.
So had that come in, I wonder if she would have been in this production, and there's that whole chess game of all the players that move in and out of the Broadway shows. What would her life have been different if she had come in with Iceman? And, you know, it's just a whole what-if game, but it's very interesting. That was
when I see the name Paul Rudd, I always think of a different actor. There was an actor named Paul Rudd before, who I first saw play cowboy in the Boston production of Boys in the Band. He later appeared with Stalker Channing down at the Lortel Theater in a play called The Lady and the Clarinet. And I don't know what happened to him, but obviously, you know, I hope he didn't die. But I mean, you know, the fact that this is the exact same name, down to the two D's in the last name, I often wonder if I'm hoping that Paul Rudd decided to pursue a different career and is very happy and healthy.
Peter, as you may or may not remember, when I was at In Theater, I think Kathy Henderson tracked him down because she remembered him very well too. I believe at the time he may have been teaching.
Okay.
But he wasn't acting anymore, but I think he may have been teaching. But I'm sorry to tell you, he died in 2010.
Did he really?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
All right. So that's the wrap up of Grace. Next show that we're going to talk about is Heresy. Peter. Yeah. We didn't plan it that way.
No, but another religious theme show, this one by A.R. Gurney. Isn't it wonderful how he still gets them out there? He was a middle-aged man when he started writing in the 70s, you know, being a teacher at MIT, at Mass Institute of Technology in Boston. And, you know, wow, you know, and here he is. He's still going. This is a play that takes place in an alternate universe because nobody is reacting whatsoever that there's a person named Pontius Pilate, there's Joseph and Mary. Oh, all right. There's a Pedro instead of a Peter, and there's a Phyllis, a woman named Phyllis, who I think represents a Philistine. You know, I gotta say that this is something you should get to fast, because Kathy Najimy, I think, is magnificent in this show, and I'm gonna
She's
go
leaving.
Out on. I know. That's my point. You know, so you got to get to it fast. And I love Karen Ziemba, who's taking over for her. And I hope and trust that she'll be just as wonderful. But Kathy Najimy is giving a hilarious performance as Pontius Pilate's wife, and she is getting increasingly drunk. But she is the type of person who thinks that she is so sophisticated and so witty, and she's a damn fool. By the way, I wish this play had been produced a couple of years ago, and I wish Katie Finneran had gone to see it. I'm one of the few people, and very few, in fact, who thought that Katie Finneran was atrocious in Promises, overdoing the drunk act at all, and I live in fear of what she's going to do to Miss Hannigan and Annie. I am not a fan at all. And the way Michael feels about the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess is the way I feel about Katie Finneran. So I wish that she could see Kathy and the Jimmy be a subtle drunk, you know, that it increasingly creeps up on her. But anyway, this is another play that deals with religion, because it takes place in the here and now. And Joseph and Mary are worried about their son, especially Mary. wonderfully played by Annette O'Toole. Wonderfully played. The mother who's concerned about her son who's been incarcerated now for he is dangerous. So that's what it's about. It's just a modern day setting of this, but. Gurney is able to get in a few points. One of them that he essentially points out that if Jesus were around today, he'd be in favor of birth control because there are just too many people on the planet. That's all there is. That Jesus was saying things back then that were relevant for those times, but times changed. There's no getting around it. And so there are issues about abortion. There are issues about priests marrying. All that stuff comes out, and I think it's really quite effective. Quite effective indeed to deal with all these issues. Another play that's going to rankle the people who believe everything the Bible says. They're going to find it sacrilegious, perhaps. They're going to find it really offensive. But for those people who want to have a little bit more of open-mindedness, I think they're going to find this very, very stimulating. There's a lot of political stuff in here, too, that we're living in a government by the rich, for the rich, on the proposition that everybody can become richer, or at least these people can. And a nice line about the fact that the American dream doesn't involve love. Yeah, and that's true. When people talk about the American dream, they never do talk about love, do they? It really does talk about success. So, but the real bottom line is that Jesus spoke to the needs of the people then. And how well does Jesus speak to the needs of the people now? These are good questions, heady questions. But, oh, that Kathy and Jimmy, I tell you. She doesn't even look like Kathy and Jimmy, by the way. If you remember Kathy and Jimmy from, let's say, Sister Act or even the Kathy and Mo show, she's lost a ton of weight. You may know that because that's not new. But her face looks a little different to me, too. I make no accusations beyond that. But anyway, her face looks different to me. Anyway, so that's my feeling about heresy.
All right. Michael, what did you think?
Well, Peter makes it sound like a much more interesting play than I think it is. I really didn't like it. I thought, it's a comedy about the Passion of Christ, basically. Well, that's not completely fair. You don't actually see his crucifixion, but you do see Pilate trying to figure out what to do with him. He's already in custody, and he's trying to decide whether to free him or not. And the discussion of what would happen to him if he were freed. But it just, I don't know. I thought there were interesting lines in it, but it felt to me very scattershot. Really no cohesion. On the one hand, yes, I agree with Peter. It's great that Gurney keeps churning them out, but I think maybe a little more time spent on each one might be a good idea. I thought a lot of it was very facile and very silly. And, I'm not sure. Oh, and one thing that annoyed, there were two things in this play that annoyed me tremendously. One was lines. For some reason, Gurney felt it necessary to kind of totally make it very meta and break the fourth wall. And there were lines to the effect of, I wonder what the critics are going to say about all this. And wasn't there even a reference to him by name, to Gurney?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know what that was supposed to be. I mean, I was obviously supposed to highlight the theatrical nature of it, but I didn't think that really helped. And there was another thing that was sort of separate from the play that I wonder if Peter will agree with me on this. This play had the most excruciating pre-show announcement.
You know, honest to God, I was going to bring that up. Here's honest to God.
I thought so.
Terrible. I don't know if we were there the same day. I was there on the Saturday
afternoon.
We were there.
You were sitting in front of me to the
left. Oh, how funny. Yeah, I thought that she was a terrible actress. She gave a pitch for a restaurant around the corner. She even gave the specials.
The menu.
The menu.
Oh, no, she didn't.
She did.
Well, the poor thing. I mean, it wasn't her fault as to what they made her say. You know, I'm sure that wasn't her idea. But she went through the. I think she gave an appetizer, an entree, and a dessert. I think as an example of what you could get.
Is this product placement creeping into Broadway?
Well, at least off Broadway. Yeah, no question. I mean, it was so blatant and so unashamed. I mean, and by the way, and I really thought she was a terrible actress.
I agree. I hate to say.
She thought she was endearing and charming and all that, and I found her thoroughly repulsive. I don't know her name, and I'm glad I don't know her name because I would say it. And I don't want to say it. So,
and there was also a lengthy pitch for the show that's coming up, or now in their other space. I Hate Fucking Mexicans. Is that right?
I thought it was Job.
Yeah.
What's that?
Job.
I'm sorry.
Job. J-O-B. The biblical guy, which, by the way, I think is what. Was going on in Grace. I think that was supposed to be a reference to suffering that Job went through. That's just a guess, but anyway.
Well, anyway, no, but she did definitely mention I hate fucking Mexicans. Because then she said, that's the title of the play. You know, as if that was a joke that she said that. But anyway, that was excruciating. And in the meantime. The Flea has joined, I'm not sure how long they've been doing this, the company of people who, companies who don't feel it necessary to give you anything in the way of a program other than this little slip that just lists the characters and the, you know, who plays them and then the creative team, but no bios whatsoever, no background. You're supposed to go online to get all of this.
Michael, honestly, I was going to mention that too. You know, I mean, I want to hear your opinion first about the play, but those two things rankled me tremendously.
I have a friend who hates that. He thinks, you know, it's the least you can do, especially at that level for actors. You know, I mean, one can argue that, you know, we're saving trees.
That's fair.
We do have the ability now to, but sometimes you like to
see it then and there.
Yes, I guess you could whip out your iPhone and but I don't know. I mean, there are limits, and so
it's funny. I did a story on Kritzelan this week about programs because I was thinking about Allegro because I was writing about Allegro for my Masterworks Broadway column, and I remember back in 1966 when I saw Allegro at BU. I came out of the theater with a friend, and I threw away the playbill, and he said, "The next Gwen Verdon might be in that playbill." And I thought, oh, yeah, sure. And I wish I had it now. And it reminded me of when Awake and Sing was on Broadway a few years ago, and I filed the playbill, and I saw my playbill from the Charles Playhouse in 1967. And I said, well, let's see who was in it. Al Pacino. You know, who knew? You know, so it's fun to go back and look at old programs and see not only who was in them, but also to read those bios and see what these people put in back then and there that they no longer put in because they have far more glorious credits, you know. So, I mean, Bernadette Peters, an early bio of hers, talks about the fact that she was once in a production of Gypsy, where she was playing Dainty June. Okay, right. Dainty June disappears at the end of the first act. However, the girl playing Agnes, one of the Toreadorables, got sick, and she had to become a Toreadorable in the second act. And, you know, that gives a whole different subtext to Gypsy, because wouldn't Rose cast someone who looked like Dainty June? You know, she would. You know she would, you know. So you know, and again, you read Bernadette Peters' bios now, and you're going to read about her, you know, her Tony for Song and Dance and her Tony for Andy Get Your Gun. I mean, it's not going to tell you about that anymore. So just that alone makes program perusing great fun, and it is something that that's you want to go to your closet and look up these things, you know, and have them. There's something about the tangible program, and who knows, you know, I mean, that's obviously, if I'm talking about 1966 and 1967, I go way back, and you know, the tradition of programs is important to me, obviously, and certainly the next generation, if they don't get them, will be used to not having them. So I understand that as well, but. I was going to bring this up. Yeah,
I have seen how you file your cast recordings.
Yeah,
but I don't think I've ever seen how you file your playbills. What, do you have like a warehouse?
Well, you've seen the cabinets in my kitchen.
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
no need for
all
plates and cups.
There. No.
We're New Yorkers. We eat out every night.
Absolutely.
Thank God.
Yeah, I agree. So, the cabinets are filled with playbills alphabetically filed. That's where they are.
So I want to point out that Heresy is playing at the Flea, and the Flea also has a few other productions going. One is I Hate Fucking Mexicans, as Michael pointed out, which is running October 9th through November 4th, and perhaps you guys will see that as well. And also Job, which is running August 31st and November 3rd. So it looks like all these things are running concurrently. They also have this another series of shows that are going there, but we won't go totally into it. Go to theflea.org as their website. We'll have it linked on BroadwayRadio.com.
Yeah, the Flea is a wonderful company, but they should stop with the pre-show announcements and they should get real programs.
I went to their website to see if any restaurants were corporate sponsors, to see if there was some sort of financial reason for them to make that announcement, but I don't see that. All right, let's move on. In some circumstances, Michael and Peter do not show up at the same theater on the same night, which leaves us for various different shows that we don't cover often. But Michael and Peter saw a lot of things in the last couple of weeks that we should at least mention. So Michael, why don't you do a little roundup, a short couple of minutes of things you want to mention. We'll do the same with Peter after.
Yes, definitely. There's a new show playing in the basement at Sophia's restaurant on 46th Street, which was for several years the home of Tony and Tina's wedding, or at least the reception part of it. And it's called How to Be a New Yorker. And it's really quite delightful. These two folks, Margaret Copeland and Kevin James Doyle, wrote and performed it. And they're very charming, and it's just a series of skits that will be hilarious to anyone, whether you are a native New Yorker or just a tourist. And they have some really fun slides that they work into it, and it's thoroughly delightful. It's, you know, just about the performance itself is not much more than an hour long, and you also get dinner beforehand, a la Tony and Tina's. So I would highly recommend that. I did get to see the New York Pops concert, Rodgers and Hammerstein concert, which we mentioned last week because Aaron Lazar was one of our guests. Their tribute to Rodgers and Hammerstein, which, you know, was pretty amazing because it was not only Aaron in the best voice I've ever heard him in, which is saying a lot, but also Kelly O'Hara and Paolo Schott. What's interesting there is that Kelly did sing. Yeah, Kelly sang I'm in Love with a Wonderful Guy, and Paolo sang, he didn't do Some Enchanted Evening, but he did This Nearly Was Mine, which was kind of brought the house down. And it was great to hear Aaron and Kelly do People Will Say We're in Love from Oklahoma. There were also the Essential Voices chorus was on hand, of which Aaron's brother, as he told us, is a member. So that was neat to have the two of them on stage. And they chimed in on various wonderful choral moments like You'll Never Walk Alone and Climb Every Mountain. And it was just basically an amazing evening. Do really, folks, if the Pops is not on your radar, you must get there. They do a lot of musical theater stuff. And, you know, with the orchestra, which is like, I don't know, 70 or 80 pieces, it's just heaven. And you don't want to miss that. Speaking again of amazing orchestras, the Met Opera is doing Otello right now. And I got to see the second performance, which was really, aside from everything else, was interesting because it was the cover was on. The first performance earlier in the week was the first one of the season. And Johann Botha apparently was not feeling well. He sang the first performance, but there were reports that he had a cold. And so this second performance, the role was played by someone called, August Amonov, who has an amazing voice. He seemed a little stiff, maybe partly because of somewhat lack of rehearsal, but musically he seemed really on top of it. And Renee Fleming, one of the Met's biggest stars, was Desdemona, or Desdemona, as it's pronounced in the opera. And I must mention Falk Strukman, who played Iago and whose acting was every bit as good as his singing. Really kind of amazing. Otello is an opera I really would recommend to several groups of people. If you love Shakespeare, but you don't know opera, then I think you would really love it. If you like musicals, and you like Shakespeare, but you don't know opera, then you really should see it. It's one of the amazing things about this opera by Verdi is that it actually condenses the plot and the story, and so it's well. Last night they performed it with one intermission. It's supposed to have two or three, but with the one intermission, it only clocked in at just over 3 hours long, like 3 hours and 5 minutes. So it's much shorter than a performance of the play itself. But the librettist Arrigo Boito did an incredible job of condensing the story. I mean, obviously he had to condense it greatly in order to allow the music, the incredible music by Verdi. But you don't feel like there's anything missing. I mean, the story is so dramatic, and the music, it's hard to imagine that it could improve this one of Shakespeare's best plays to such a degree. But it really does, and I would really urge you to go. Also, the production has been in the repertoire for some time, so it's not one of these odd, strange, weird, new concept productions. It's done very, I would say, very much traditionally, and you know, and set in the original time, and the costumes and the sets are pretty amazing, and the choral work is incredible, and Otello. I would highly recommend it as an entry opera for people who are into Shakespeare, and it's really kind of amazing. And then I cannot I don't need to say much about the production of A Chorus Line that is now on at Paper Mill, except go. It's amazing. I mean, I will say I was there on opening night, and the excitement factor was ratcheted up about 8 million watts because the audience included many alumni who had done the show either in the last Broadway revival or various companies, and they brought them up after the finale for a sort of a reprise of part of the finale, including the choreography afterwards, and that was incredibly exciting. I was not at the famous performance of the Broadway Chorus Line where it was it the one where it broke the record. In that case, that they did something similar, and that apparently was one of the greatest nights in Broadway history. So it wasn't quite at that level, but it still was very exciting. And also to have those people in the audience for the show, I mean, they were as soon as the lights went down, the cheering began, and you don't usually get audiences like that at Paper Mill for any number of reasons. So the show was done so well to begin with, directed and choreography restaged by Mitzi Hamilton, and a really great cast, including Rochelle Rack as Sheila, and Jessica Lee Golden as Cassie. And I think I would say, honestly, that this production is superior to both the last Paper Mill production, which was about 10 years ago, and the recent Broadway revival, because to me, overall, the acting, and I would say the direction, were better. even though there were some choices that, well, it was interesting, actually. For example, Cassie, as played by Jessica Lee Golden, was much more overtly sexual than I have ever seen her played before. And although it wasn't, I would say, the definitive performance, it did add a different feeling to it, especially in the discussion of her previous relationship with Zach. And then when she said, then it made it believable in a different way when she talks about how she went out to Hollywood and she just couldn't make it. She actually says it at one point, "I can't act." But you, since she was so beautiful and so sexy, you could understand why Hollywood would have, snapped her up and tried to do something with her. And then it not happen because she couldn't, as she says, she couldn't act. So that was really interesting to me, that gave a whole different feel to it. And also Zach was played by Martin Harvey, who is British, apparently, and that with a very strong Brit accent. So that called to mind things like Simon Cowell, sitting in judgment of these people, and although, again, realistically it might not have been made a lot of sense because I don't think there were any British director choreographers working on Broadway in 1975 that come to mind, but it did, again, it just gave it a whole different spin that was very interesting. And I you must see this production if you love Chorus Line, if you love musical theater. It's not that hard to get to Paper Mill. The tickets are cheaper than Broadway, not a whole lot, but certainly significantly. I cannot recommend it too highly.
All right. So that wraps up Michael's section. Peter, have you got to talk about?
Well, segueing from Chorus Line, I'm going to paraphrase a lyric about going down a very steep and narrow stairway to go see 1931 Dash. Now, this is a play from 1931, but when it was written, it was actually called 1931 Dash. I don't mean D-A-S-H. I mean there's a little dash, a little hyphen right after the date. For example, if any one of us were being written about today, it would give our birthday and would have a dash, and there would be no date afterwards because we're still alive. Okay. Well, this is a play about what it's like to live in 1931, and the dash represents the fact, well, when will this end? Because it's all about the Depression. This is a play produced by the Regroup Theater, which does plays that were done originally by the Group Theater. And this was a play written at the time about how tough things were during the Depression. A guy has a job. He gets into an altercation with his boss. Now, the gentleman who is working for the boss is not at fault here. The other man is not paying attention, but he's the boss, and he bumps into him, and it causes a little bit of disconcerting things with boxes. They go all over the place, and the boss starts yelling at him. Well, the young man knows it's not his fault, and he's going to stand up for his rights. And by standing up for his rights, he gets fired. And that leads him on a downward spiral, because in the Depression, it's not easy to get a job. 2012, right? So as a result, you see him just, things get worse and worse and worse for him. And the question becomes, should a man stand up for himself in tough times, or does he just have to bite the bullet, swallow his pride, that it takes away your humanity when things get really too tough? Fascinating play. Brilliantly done, directed by Ali Mulholland. It is definitely something I hope that everybody goes to see. A guy named Stephen Dexter is phenomenal, phenomenal. One of the finest performances I've seen this year, if not the finest, probably the finest. It's out of the way. It's at 21 Clinton Street. It's at the Living Theater. Not that hard to get to. The F train will get you very close there. And this company is one really worth supporting, because they really are doing plays of yore, discovering them, rediscovering them, and bringing them to our attention. This is a full production. And it really is extraordinarily memorable. And I am so delighted. I went to this out-of-the-way theater, and I think everybody should. I also saw Detroit finally, and that's a play in which a couple has the couple over from next door to visit. And, the other couple makes the point that, you know, neighbors just aren't neighborly anymore. You know, you can't go over to a neighbor and say, give me a cup of sugar the way they used to do way back when. But maybe we shouldn't get to know our neighbors too well, because these people have a ton of problems, and these people are going to lead to the ruination of the couple who was gracious enough to invite them into their home. So so it does bring up the point that maybe isolationism is the best policy where it comes to having neighbors. The Best of Everything, based on Rona Jaffe's novel, down at Here, down 6th Avenue, is a very straightforward adaptation of that book that I was reading as a teenager that my aunt Vera pulled out of my hand, saying, "You're not supposed to be reading that." It was her book, of course, but it does deal with office politics as people saw them back in the 50s, and it's a very good adaptation on how we've changed and how we haven't changed. One woman in the office talks endlessly about her wedding, talks endlessly about the dress, describing it in detail, describing everything that everybody's going to eat at the wedding, from appetizer to dessert, all that kind of stuff. And she gets married, and she has a baby, and she thinks that her life is going to be terrific. She comes back to the office, and she starts crying because she realizes what she's given up, and that having a career was a pretty good thing, and she didn't realize it. That's just one of the facets of it, believe me. It's also dealing with another person has to deal with a tough boss, and eventually becomes a tough boss herself, not as tough as the boss she had, I'll grant you. But it shows how much we've changed and how much we haven't. It gets serious. It gets very serious at one point because a girl gets pregnant. In those days, you know, having an abortion was tough stuff. You know, it was as tough as some political party now would like it to be again. So so that was pretty impressive. So as for Don't Go Gentle and Falling, which I both enjoyed immeasurably, I guess we'll catch up on that when Michael gets to them, and we'll talk about those. Though I can give a preview to saying both are worthwhile ventures. So so that's my wrap up.
All right. Thanks, Peter. In our just going to talk about a few news things before we run out the door and wrap up here. Michael had, I should say, passionately emailed Peter and I about Sam French's new venture. Michael, do you want to describe it?
Yeah, I don't want to describe it, but I will. Okay, I'll just read the press release because it's not that long. Samuel French starts a symphony of their own partnership, et cetera. Samuel French solidified a partnership with Right on Cue Services earlier this month for the creation and distribution of musical accompaniment tracks for Samuel French musicals. This new service will be called Symphony and will be available October 1st, 2012. The initial launch will include a select group of popular properties from within the French catalog, such as Happy Days, Zombie Prom, and Nonsense. ROCS is a high-quality professional music production company which specializes in accompaniment products for musical theater. These products are invaluable rehearsal and performance tools, especially in the amateur market, and will enhance the, quote, producibility of many shows, giving theaters access to many musicals they may not have been able to produce otherwise. The new products available in the Symphony program will include a rehearsal product and two different performance track options. One which employs the play-and-go model, and the other a revolutionary performance product that gives the conductor full control over tempo, enabling him, her, to vamp, slow down, speed up, hold, or stop the song all in real time. Now, I don't know about you, but I think this is one of the worst things I've heard in a long time. It might not seem like such a big deal, but really, I mean, we can't get further away from live people doing theater and making music. You know, if you want to rehearse with tracks, even that is somewhat damaging because it's necessary, you know, to have the give and take between, even if it's just a single pianist, you know, there's something that happens there. It's very different from someone, just singing to a recorded track. And yes, it says that this one will be able to be controlled by the conductor, but it's still, you know, it's not live people sitting there and playing. Even it's just a piano, bass, and drums. I don't know about you, Peter. I don't know what your personal experience was in doing high school and college shows, but God knows you've seen more of them probably than any of us. And I'm sure you've seen every different range of accompaniment of those shows, from a single piano to a large full orchestra. You do what you can, but I've always thought and continue to think that having live musicians, even a relatively small amount of them, is far superior to having tracks, orchestral tracks or whatever. And I think this is very, very dangerous. And I'm kind of amazed that they're doing it, to be honest. I'm wondering what Peter's perspective.
Sure, I agree. However, I'm going to bring up 2 points here in their favor. I was in Collinsville, Illinois, and I was seeing a community theater production of The Wizard of Oz, where they had a full orchestra. And the moment they began the overture, and of course everybody knows what the overture of The Wizard of Oz sounds like, because we've all seen that movie a million times, I could see that the audience thought, uh-oh, we're in trouble, because the orchestra was so poor.
Oh.
And one of the things that does cause a problem for amateur productions, the fact that so many times the people on stage are terrific, but the people in the pit are not. For whatever reason, it seems harder for musicians to deal with the music than it does with amateur. Let me make that clear. It is harder for amateur musicians to deal with the music than it seems to be for amateur actors to deal with their roles. That may be a hasty generalization, but it's something that seems to be true. So I can understand why a lot of productions that have been sabotaged by lousy musicians might welcome this, that it does solve the problem. The other point I'm going to make is, given the fact that so many shows I've seen, especially on tour, at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, have about, 5, 6, seriously, pieces in the orchestra, and it's pumped through the sound system to make it sound louder. I'm not sure there's going to be a profound difference between that and what Sam French is doing. First choice, of course, let's see those musicians in the pit. I used to love when I used to go to the theater as a kid and sit in the balcony, the second balcony, because that's all I could afford. Little did I know what prices were coming, you know, I mean, but nevertheless, and to look into that pit and to see all those musicians, and even a harp, you know, there always was a harp in those days, was just thrilling. And to have that taken away is very regrettable. And of course, you know, I'm going to bring up a very strange analogy here, but I remember one time a guy talking about the fact that marijuana should never be legalized, because if it is, then everybody will say, well, then let's legalize cocaine. And by not legalizing marijuana, we don't legalize cocaine. All right, where's my analogy? Well, the fact is, if we allow this in amateur productions, how long will it be before we have them in professional productions? And frankly, I know of theaters that do have professional, that are professional, that do use orchestral tracks as opposed to real musicians. I know there are theaters around the country that do it. I've seen them. I've been there. And but what I have to also admit is that I don't see much different from the amped up sound that I get when I go to NJPAC.
Right, so. But that's, yeah, well, absolutely, but that situation shouldn't exist either.
You bet!
For there to be 5 or 6 pieces in an orchestra at the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, and for it to be over-amplified in an attempt to convince
make
you
it
that...
seem like this, it's a big
that, yeah, yeah, that's...
Mamma Mia on Broadway is a much better play.
Yes.
Mamma Mia on Broadway is much better.
Is say that again?
Mamma Mia on Broadway is not much better. There aren't that many music... there either, and they're pumping up the volume. I'll never forget when the second act started in Mamma Mia, and I'm going back when I first saw it, 10 years ago, whatever it was, people weren't quite in their seats, you know, and the lights weren't quite dim yet, and suddenly the orchestra started, and people like jumped as if they were jolted by electricity, because it was so loud, you know, and they didn't see it coming. So anyway,
and as far as the other, not to belabor this, but I don't know. I mean, when I did shows in high school, it tended to be in high schools that either did not have a strong orchestra program or didn't have one at all. And so in those cases, they would just hire professionals to play in the orchestra, whether, you know, whether two or three or a full orchestra. And so I think that's the answer to that. I mean, if you can't get students who can handle it, I mean, heaven knows, Peter and I just saw Fiorello at NYU, and the orchestra was quite excellent. So it can be done in the right places. But if not, then, you know, just hire a few people and let the – it's supposed to be a learning experience aside from everything else, for
yes,
God's sake.
That's fair.
I mean, well, this is not specifically for schools, that this Samuel French thing. It's well, you know, it's for anyone really, I guess, any kind of situation. I just think it's terrible. I think it's a very bad step in a very, very wrong direction.
So a perfect night out for Michael is not to go see Tracy Bennett in End of the Rainbow with pre-recorded orchestra tracks directed by
Diane Paulus, right?
Diane Paulus.
Yeah, right.
And rewritten
by Susan Laurie Parks.
Laurie Parks, okay. Right, yeah. Excellent. So it's funny.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad we got Tracy Bennett in again. You know,
well, you know, I try every
week. Because
she
gave a great performance in End of the Rainbow. I mean, she was extraordinary.
You people, you've inextricably linked me with her in my hatred, but I'm sorry. She was so horrible in that show. I'm sure she's wonderful in other things. You know, the whole.
Well, as an old folk song says, but we've been through that a million times or more,
yeah,
and we will
guys,
again.
You guys keep bringing it up.
I know. I know. And by the way, I'm raring to go next week. I guarantee you I'll bring it up next week, too.
Do we think that Tracy Bennett was mentioned in Arthur Lawrence's book that Mr. Riedel talked about this week? Have you guys read the book?
I've started it. I'll tell you the truth. What's happened is that David Rothenberg, the press agent, wrote a book, and that took me away from it. And I read that, and that's a very good book called Fortune in My Eyes. And then what happened is I got another book in the mail from Ron Brugere, who worked around Broadway in the 60s and 70s. So that pulled me away from Arthur Lawrence's book. So I have to say that I'm about 50 pages into Arthur Lawrence's book. And so far, most of it has to do with personal issues and his relationship with Tom Hatcher over the years. It's very tenderly written, and certainly there's no question it's a great love story. But I haven't come across very much about the workings of the shows, which always interests me more than people's personal lives. So the book by Ron Brugere called Collision is of much more interest to me because he's really talking about what it was like to be a stage manager working with Carol Channing and Charles Lowe. Need I say more? So that's why I seem to be pulled away from Arthur's book.
All right. Michael, did you have something to say about it? Because Mr. Riedel's column is, we'll link to it in the show notes, but it's very interesting.
Well, I don't know. I it certainly will probably be interesting to read, but I don't know. I think he was one of
you're
the
in
most,
no hurry to read.
He was one of the most toxic personalities in the history of Broadway. And I think he kind of took
Riedel
pleasure
or Lawrence?
In, Arthur Lawrence.
Okay.
And I think he took pleasure in that. So I don't even think that's, you know, he would. I don't know if you'd even mind that I say that, but many people obviously seem to feel that way. What Michael Riedel specifically dealt with, one of the things was the whole Matt Kavanaugh situation. If that's true, then that's just one more really kind of black mark on what happened with Mr. Lawrence, especially later in his career. I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to read it.
Well, so that's not the most outrageous thing that was said this week in the news. in a collision of the National Enquirer meets Broadway, we have a headline here that Sarah Brightman is taking a space vacation and is going out to space with the Russians for $51 million and a week or so. And you had to say that, is this true? And then it seems as though it is. So are we sending Christine Daae? Is it Phantom in Space? Will this be the third follow-up to the Phantom of the Opera?
Oh, that's an idea. You know, I mean, for the next sequel.
Yeah, right.
The next sequel. The middle one didn't seem to work at Coney Island. I don't. It seems to have dropped off of everybody's radar screens. It doesn't look like it's going to at least happen here in New York. They are making the film of it down in Australia, but Sarah Brightman out in space. Is there anything to say?
The best comment I heard was, "It's somebody said it's not far enough away for me."
I'll never forget interviewing Sarah Brightman when she was doing an album of obscure show songs. It's a pretty good album, too, by the way, especially for including one selection from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Oh.
But anyway, at that point, she was married to Andrew Lloyd Webber. And I have a policy that when I deal with somebody who is more famous for being married or related to somebody famous, I never mention the famous person. I will not do that. For example, when I interviewed Lorna Luft last year, I didn't mention Judy Garland, okay? That right. type of thing. All right. So so I get in there, and I ask my standard question that I always ask about albums, you know, that there are so many selections on the album, but there must have been one song that you really wanted to do that you just couldn't fit on the album. What was that song? So I asked her, and the first word out of her mouth was, "Andrew thought that I should do these songs," and, you know, so right away she brings him into the conversation. She was meek. She was mild. She looked like she was in agony that she had to be interviewed. Her face was downcast. It was really sad. Okay, the next time I interviewed her was after the divorce. You may recall that she went to Aspects of Love. Even though they had been divorced, she was going to come in and she was going to take over the role that Ann Crumb had started. So I got there first, and she came in like a ball of fire and happy-go-lucky and shaking the end. I couldn't believe the transition. But I guess when you get a $6 million settlement, you know, you do get empowered in a way that you weren't before. I mean, she was no longer the wife. She was no longer under his thumb. It was just fascinating to see how she had blossomed. And I guess $6 million would do a lot of us a lot of good. You know, there's no question about that. But the difference was more than night and day. I mean, it was a million nights. It was enough of a distance that perhaps she's traveling now. That's the distance between the two Sarah Brightmans I saw. But this was definitely the headline this year that made me say, wait a minute, I'm not reading this correctly. This can't be what's happening.
You know? Well, I will never forget. I have been down on her since. I will never, ever forget this. This was one of the most pissy things I've ever heard anyone say, especially publicly. And this was when they were still married. This was when Phantom was coming to Broadway. I saw her interviewed on TV, and she certainly was not meek on this occasion. Okay. Because if you recall, there was some question as to whether or not she was going to be able to recreate her performance in Phantom on Broadway, because at the time, she really was not a star by any, you know, it really was just the fact that she was married to him and she had done it in London. And so it really, for a while, looked like she might not get to do it. And I will never forget, somebody on TV asked her about it, and she literally said, "Well, the person I really feel bad for is the person who winds up doing it, because that person will always know that she was the second choice." And I hated her since that moment. So that's a full disclosure.
So let's, Peter mentioned about headlines that we have to wonder if it's real again. And we saw this headline that Breakfast at Tiffany's headed to Broadway.
Yeah.
We've seen that headline before, but this is a new production, isn't it?
Yes, it's not the Bob Merrill musical from way back when, which I did see in Boston when it was called Holly Go Lightly. an album has since come out. Robert Scheer came out with an album, and showing that the score wasn't as bad as we thought it was in 1966. This is a straight play version by Richard Nelson, is it? Richard Greenberg? I always get them confused.
Richard Greenberg, yes.
Greenberg, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Both very good playwrights. So we'll see what happens. There was a play of Breakfast at Tiffany's done in London a couple of years ago. This is not that one.
This is
yet another one. So people are still fascinated by Holly Go Lightly and her adventures.
Are you guys fans of the movie?
Ha, I will never forget being in high school. I went to a high school where right across the street was a suburban movie theater. And I remember seeing Breakfast at Tiffany's on the marquee and thinking, wow, I would love to see that picture, you know. And suddenly something happened that we got out of school for the day and I went across the street and saw the picture. It was much too sophisticated for me at the time. I was thoroughly confused by it. I didn't understand the $50 for the powder room. I didn't understand when Buddy Ebsen showed up as her old husband. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. But it is quite a wonderful movie, and not least of which because of Henry Mancini's wonderful score. And I don't just mean Moon River. I mean, the entire score is just terrific.
Well, although the film, I have seen the film, and although it's quite legendary, especially for the performance of Audrey Hepburn as Holly Golightly, I have not read the novella. I really should do that. But apparently it's very, very different. The film is very different, and specifically in the way that character is portrayed, partly because of the fact that at the time the film was made, they felt they couldn't be very open about the fact that Holly is, to all intents and purposes, a call girl, a hooker, whatever word you want to use. I mean, she's not a streetwalker, but she basically sells herself to men. So that was soft-pedaled. And Audrey Hepburn was a very different type than the character is portrayed in the novella. So in that sense, if nothing else, it will be interesting to see how this version turns out. And what's interesting to me is that they have already announced that Holly Golightly will be played by a British actress, Amelia Clarke. Interesting that such a very American character will be played by a British woman, kind of shades of Scarlett O'Hara, among probably many other examples we could think of. But that's interesting. I wonder who's going to wind up playing the other roles. And I wonder, I'm not sure, I asked someone, I'm not sure if the notorious Mickey Rooney character is in the novella. But if he is, you can be damn sure that he will be played by an actual Asian person, not by somebody like Mickey Rooney doing an outrageous impersonation, quote unquote, of an Asian.
Well, my thoughts about Breakfast at Tiffany's is that I watched the movie to see Audrey Hepburn. I don't watch the movie because I thought it was a great story. I didn't think it was well directed. I don't know if this is going to, if this was Audrey Hepburn starring in Breakfast at Tiffany's on Broadway, I think it would have it. I just don't know how they're going to sell this other than because people are going to come wanting to see an Audrey Hepburn type of character, type of performance.
And well, that's the thing. That's a very good point, James. I mean, she is, as I said, apparently completely different.
Yeah.
Than the character as portrayed in the novella, I have been told, is much more like Marilyn Monroe, who in fact was considered for the film, but then she actually died before it was made, so that was a moot point. So on the one hand, Audrey Hepburn was very different than what was portrayed in the novella, but she has become iconic in a similar way to the way that she is actually somewhat miscast in My Fair Lady. And at the time, her casting was criticized. I mean, aside from the fact that she didn't sing the role, she is not quite maybe what Eliza was originally, but just through her own acting ability, her own incredible, her beauty, her presence, that indefinable something she had on screen. Now people look at My Fair Lady and they're like, oh, well, she's wonderful. I mean, I think a great many people say that. So it's a similar thing here.
All right. Let's just hit the headlines really quickly. We're running very late. Before we get out of here is American Repertory Theater, or ART, is mounting a production of Pippin, where Diane Paulus is reconceiving it. And it seems to be lining up quite the cast with Matthew James Thomas, Patina Miller, Andrew Martin, Terrence Mann are headlining there. Do we think that they are going to be Gunning for Broadway.
Yes.
And we have a few of the things happening here. We had Van Dien, producer, on a few weeks ago, and there was just he was producer, Broadway producer. He also owns Broadway Records, and they are going to be releasing live recordings from 54 Below. So be nice to capture some of those things, right, Michael?
Yeah, I was very happy to read that. I think that's a great idea, and I think it's made possible by the fact that it's, you know, generally speaking, I think it's much easier to make those kind of recordings nowadays than it was even a few years ago. So I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, looking forward to that. Have you on another topic? Have you seen CVR, Charlie Victor Romeo, when it's been here in New York before?
You know, James, I cannot bring myself to go see it.
Yeah,
I just think it would be so upsetting. Why don't we tell people what it is?
Well, Charlie Victor Romeo, CVR, stands for the cockpit voice recorder, which is in all airplanes. And Charlie Victor Romeo is, they have got transcripts of plane crashes, and they talk about what happens in the moments before it. And it's very disconcerting to some, as Michael has pointed out, and but it's an incredible view into what happens right before tragedy. And
yeah,
it's been done in New York a number of times, and it's coming back again.
Yes. In a somewhat similar way, I cannot go to see The Exonerated again, but I urge everyone who has not seen it to go. The Exonerated is based on actual interviews with actual death row inmates. Is that the term? Death row?
Yeah.
Inmates. That didn't sound right when I was going to say it. Yeah, actual death row inmates about their experiences. It was one of the most extraordinary theatrical events I've ever seen when it was off Broadway the first time. And now it's back with an amazing cast of rotating stars, including Stockard Channing, and I'm sorry, I don't have the list ahead of me. In front of me, do you, Peter?
No, I don't have the Exonerated.
Well, they can bring people in, because it's they just basically sit there and read and speak the transcripts of playing the roles of these people, and they're actually having two of the actual exonerees, people who were eventually found, after spending sometimes years on death row, who were freed because it turns out that they were found to be innocent. And it's a very, very powerful argument against capital punishment, if only for the reason that it's absolutely tragic and shocking how many times people are killed wrongly. I mean, wrongly in the sense that it turns out they did not commit the crime, aside from the fact of whether one feels that people should be killed even if they did commit the crime. So it's really go see The Exonerated. You will never forget it.
On their website, they have a rotating cast of Stockard Channing, Brian Dennehy, Steve Earle, John Forte, Catherine Grody, Marg Helgenberger,
yeah.
Christine Lottie, Delroy Lindo, Lyle Lovett, Richard Mazur, Michael McKean, Joe Morton, Chris Sarandon, Brooke Shields, Martin Short, Danton Stone. So yeah, it's quite the revolving cast there.
And by the way, nice to see
the Culture Project. Yeah,
nice to see Michael McKean's name there. So I guess he's doing better after his very unfortunate car accident.
Yeah. Exactly. All right. So let's wrap up here. Peter had to drop off because we were having a technical problem. So don't think that we're not asking Peter's opinion on these last few things. I want to remind everybody that you should go to BroadwayRadio.com to check out our show notes. In our show notes, we have links to all the different things we've talked about today, plus some videos from Grace, Enemy of the People. We have a video from Heresy. So there's lots of great additional stuff there to check out on the show page. If you want to subscribe to these podcasts on that show page, there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Please leave us positive feedback in iTunes, because that will help us with Apple rankings, and Apple will promote the show to other folks who like Broadway. You can listen to us on the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone or your Android devices and your BlackBerry. And you can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. We need listener volunteers. A bunch of people have reached out and said hello to me and offered their services, and we still need more. So if you have a few hours and you are able to help us out, please drop me an email at james@broadwayradio.com. Michael, Peter, and my contact information are also on broadwayradio.com. So if you need to get in touch with us, all of that stuff is there as well. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.